Hello, this is Randy Thompson from the Triangle Radio Reading Service. Welcome to Music Review. The content of this program is intended for a blind and print-impaired audience. For the next half hour, I shall be reading articles about music from such sources as the New York Times, the News and Observer, the Week Magazine, Rolling Stone, and Entertainment Weekly. Music Review is designed to provide the latest coverage of classical, folk, jazz, blues, rock, country, and pop music news. But first, these musical trivia questions. Today's musical trivia questions come to us from the website onthisday.com. Question number one, it was on this very day back in 2014 that Metallica became the first band to perform a concert on all seven of Earth's continents. So which continent was this last one to host their concert? Hint, Metallica had already performed on the continents of Asia, Africa, North America, South America, Europe, and Australia. So which continent must have been this last one? And question number two, what happened on this day back in 1960 when the singer Fabian visited Elvis Presley at Graceland? Was it A, the two got into a fight about the best post-Thanksgiving sandwich? Was it B, Fabian had to lend Elvis his pants because Elvis had ripped his, demonstrating karate? Was it C, they recorded a holiday album together? Or was it D, Fabian designed what would become Elvis's signature gold lamé jumpsuit? The answers to these two very important musical trivia questions will be given, as usual, at the end of today's program. Our transitions come to us from that same website, onthisday.com, and today, quote-unquote, is the weekend of December the 7th. Well, it was on this day, back in 1865, that composers Jean Johann Julius Christian Sibelius was born. Sibelius is known for such compositions as Finlandia. And it was 38 years ago today, 1980, in New York City, that Mark David Chapman shot John Lennon to death. Earlier on this day, Lennon had autographed an album for Chapman. 1980. And in country and folk music news, we have this review of an album. It's by First Aid Kit, and the name of the album is Ruins. R-U-I-N-S, Ruins. And it's given 3.5 stars by the reviewer, Will Hermes, and published in Rolling Stone magazine, 22nd of February 2018. Scandinavian sisters spool out country folk grandeur. On their 2012 hit, Emmy Lou, Swedes Clara and Johanna Soderberg repurposed country harmony into a bright new thing, producing their fourth set, folk rock impressionist Tucker Maritime, Nico Case, My Morning Jacket, The Decemberist, helped shape a dreamy grandeur with touches of pedal steel and guitar atmospherics. From REM alum Peter Buck, like a Sergio Leone film starring Lana Del Rey. Doubled at times, the musical ornamentation can be a little much, but when these two voices combine, it falls away. And in classical music news, we have this article titled, Too dangerous. Security confiscates cellist strings at Warsaw Airport. This is published in ClassicFM.com on the 19th of November, 2018, by Maddie Shaw Roberts. Cellist Amit Peled was at Warsaw Chopin Airport at 4:30 a.m. yesterday when all of his cello strings were confiscated by the airport security. He says staff at the Polish airport believe they were too dangerous to take on board. Over email to Classic FM, he said, I just performed with the Warsaw Philharmonic the Penderecki Cello Concerto No. 2 last night for the maestro's 85th birthday celebration, he said. What a huge honor and an incredible musical celebration to be part of. However, for the first time in my life, all strings were taken away from me at Warsaw Airport's security checkpoint, claiming that it's too dangerous to take them on board. Well, that is a first. I have always carried an extra set of strings with me and was never asked to give them away. Well, at least they didn't take the cello, claiming that the end pin could be used to stab somebody. In an email to Classic FM, Warsaw Chopin Airport defended their employees' actions, saying, when checking the passengers' hand luggage, the security control operator noted that there are cello strings in it, which, due to their properties in accordance with the regulations, are classified as prohibited articles. It is the employee of the security checkpoint who, basing on the regulations, makes the final decision on allowing the item to be taken on board the aircraft. Items that raise doubts cannot be accepted for transport in hand luggage. But the passenger has the option of placing the item in registered luggage, which goes to the aircraft hold. The security control operator, after questioning the possibility of carrying cello strings on board, repeatedly proposed to the passenger the possibility to put them in checked-in luggage, but the passenger declined. We are extremely sorry that this has happened at our airport, but we regard security issues as our priority. And in jazz and blues music news, we have this article written by John Wirt in TheAdvocate.com on the 22nd of November 2018, entitled Album Review, Baton Rouge Blues Musicians Appear on Compilation, curated by the Rolling Stones. 2 years ago, the Rolling Stones released Blue and Lonesome, a surprise album featuring the band's spontaneously recorded interpretations of 12 blues classics. The project includes the Stones' rendition of songs by Baton Rouge blues artist Lightning Slim and Marksville harmonica ace Little Walter Jacobs. Confessin' the Blues, a newly released 2-CD compilation curated by the Rolling Stones, features the original Lightning Slim and Jacobs recordings in a 42-track collection of blues, rock and roll, and boogie-woogie classics. Recordings by Louisiana artists appear across Confessin' the Blues, Slim Harpo's 1957 Excello Records debut, I'm a King Bee, recorded by the Stones for their 1964 album debut, no less than 4 Little Walter songs, Buddy Guy's Incendiary 1991 track Damn Right I've Got the Blues, Lightning Slim's Hoodoo Blues, recorded by the Stones for Blue and Lonesome, and Dale Hawkins' swamp rock hit Susie Q. Inspired by American blues, the Rolling Stones have been activist fans of the genre for more than 50 years. In 1965, for instance, they demanded that the producer of TV Shindig book one of their heroes, Helen Wolfe, or the Stones wouldn't do the show. Wolfe's network television debut was a breakthrough for the blues genre. Confessin' the Blues is a logical follow-up to Blue and Lonesome. The double album stretches from early 20th century legend Robert Johnson to the still touring and recording guy. The Stones' choices show their love and extensive knowledge of the genre. A portion of the sales will benefit Willie Dixon's Blues Heaven Foundation. It should be noted that this album's release comes at a time an important conversation is being had about white appropriation of the blues, a genre built by black musicians. Some point to the Rolling Stones' 2018 Best Traditional Blues Album Grammy win for Blue and Lonesome as cultural appropriation, in that the record's inclusion shoved out deserving black musicians who depend on nominations for exposure. And in music research and technology, we have this article written by David Brown, published in Rolling Stone magazine, February 8th through 22nd, 2018 issue. Music merch gold rush. As album sales have tanked, labels are creating everything from $1,000 artist branded jackets to punk rock board shorts. 3 years ago, Fall Out Boy opened a pop-up store in New York selling T-shirts in a space that resembled a punk rock club. When the band revisited the idea at stores in New York and L.A. this past fall, the vibe and decor were noticeably upgraded. Purple-tinted windows made fans feel as if they were walking onto the cover of the band's new album, Mania. And among the items on sale were hand-painted $150 denim jackets. It's bigger now and more money is coming through, says Chris Cornell, whose merch company, Manhead, works with Fall Out Boy, Shania Twain, and other artists. It's amazing how far it's come. Music merchandise, T-shirts, posters, etc., once an ancillary part of an artist's income, has become a booming business. In 2016, sales of music merch hit $3.1 billion, a 10% increase from the year before, says Licensing Industry Merchandisers Association. Retail analytics group Edited claims that the sheer volume of music-related items on the market has tripled in the past 2 years. Music has migrated to being more digital, says Matt Vlasic, who runs the merch company Bravado, so fans are craving something physical. At artist-affiliated online stores, retail outlets, pop-up shops, and concert fans are now confronted by an increasingly high-end variety of consumer choices. $240 denim Sherpa jackets, The Weeknd, $1,050 thigh-high boots, Kanye West, and $1,095 Canada Goose bomber jackets with collars made of coyote fur, Drake's OVO line. As this new profit center has taken off, artists themselves are getting more involved in day-to-day operations. Taylor Swift and Morrissey opened pop-up stores in the fall, and Iggy Pop made color suggestions for his new line of Billabong board shorts. Recently, Beyoncé and Jared Leto both invested in Sidestep, an app that allows fans to buy concert merch online and pick it up at the venue prior to a show. Some people like standing in line, says Jesper Poulsen of the licensing firm Epic Rights. For me personally, it's a buzzkill. Although some in the industry question West's claim that he sold $1 million in merchandise in 2 days during a pop-up store event in 2016, there's no question that profits can be sizable. Drake's pop-up events have brought in six-figure sales numbers, according to Panic at the Disco's manager, Bob McLinn. 30% of the band's profit on its most recent tour came from merch. Ever since CD started going by the wayside, everybody was like, how are we going to make more money, says Cornell. In a sign of the merch world's flourishing success, a secondary market has emerged at its margins. Fans are scooping up items at pop-up stores and reselling them online at pumped-up prices. They're getting a couple $100 for a T-shirt that costs $25, says Francis Wong of Sony's Thread Shop merch agency. After our Tribe Called Quest pop-up, people were selling the shopping bags online for $25. It was hilarious.
You must try to ignore that it means more than
Tina Turner's What's Love Got to Do With It introduces this book review titled, Tina Turner Looks Back on Her Horrific First Marriage and So Much More. The book is My Love Story by Tina Turner with Deborah Davis, Dominic Wichman also, and it's published by Atria, 272 pages. And this review is written by David Kirby for the Washington Post and published in the News and Observer on the 21st of October, 2018. Tina Turner's second memoir following 1986's I, Tina, is filled with the lessons that can only be delivered by someone who has been around the block a few times and lived to tell about it. The first lesson is, run from snakes. Born Anna Mae Bullock in Nutbush, Tennessee in 1939, the country girl who would become a rhythm and blues icon learned early that when a snake reared its head, it was time to skedaddle. Something always told me when to run, Tina says in a prologue to My Love Story. Though reading will sometimes wish she'd listened to that voice even more. Because hovering over her this book is the outsized figure of the late Ike Turner, also a seminal musician. His Rocket 88 is often credited as the first rock and roll song, yet best known for having married, managed, and nearly killed his more famous wife. Like the dynamic figure in Disney's Fantasia, Ike looms, leers, and strikes when Tina and the reader least expect it. Tina describes two weddings in My Love Story. The first is a quickie marriage to Ike in Tijuana. In a portent of what the future holds, Ike drags her afterward to a live sex show at a brothel. The second ceremony, a Kardashians on steroids affair in which Tina weds record executive Irwin Bach years later, is described much more elaborately, even if it fails to engage reader interest as much as the Tijuana fiasco does. Soon Tina is installed in Ike's L.A. mansion along with three mistresses, all named Anne. You can't make stuff like that up, writes Tina. He only had to remember one name. Hooked on cocaine and peach brandy, Ike threw hot coffee in Tina's face, broke her jaw, gave her one too many black eyes that she can't remember being without one. She was a frequent visitor to the emergency room where she was victimized a second time by the racism of the day. The doctors never reported her quote-unquote accidents because they probably thought that was just the way black people were, fighting like that, especially husbands and wives. And that brings us to the second lesson of My Love Story, which is to pay attention. Tina looks for her opportunity to escape, and when Ike falls asleep exhausted one night after yet another beating, Tina grabs a toiletries case, ties a scarf over her head, and runs out of their hotel and across the interstate as trucks thunder past, and seeks refuge in a Ramada Inn. Filthy and blood-spattered, with 36 cents and a mobile credit card in her pocket. All along, though, she has been watching how other people live and preparing for her new life. As little Anna Mae Bullock, else she provided child care for a Nutbush couple who showed her what a beautiful home and a happy marriage looked like. That would now be possible, but first, she had a lot of business to take care of, including going through a court battle to gain control over their name, Tina Turner, which Ike had trademarked. From there, My Love Story stops being a tell-all and becomes a DIY guide to successful branding. There's actually not a lot of music here in her telling. Tina's contribution to rock and soul is a combination of the strength of her personality and a vocal power to match. In a pair of passages, she describes how she stamped her distinctive style on two of her biggest hits, Proud Mary and What's Love Got to Do With It, the song that opened today's episode. But what as far as music goes, the bulk of this book is about becoming somebody and marketing that person to the world. When Tina emerges from Ike's shadow and steps finally to the front of the stage, she has every detail covered and leaves nothing to chance, not even the wig she describes as a critical part of the Tina Turner look. She's so good at branding that producers of Mad Max Beyond Thunderdome referred to the movie's larger-than-life heroine as the Tina Turner character. They kept saying, let's get someone like Tina Turner, until finally it occurred to someone to ask the real Tina Turner to take the part. And it's the real Tina Turner who inspires women who've gone through what she has to make their lives better. One fan at a concert is overheard saying, I came because I was looking for the courage to leave the man who beats me. Tonight, I found that courage. The last few chapters of my love story will remind you why you should never ask an older person how they're doing. Tina describes her dialysis and eventual kidney transplant in as much detail as she devotes to her wedding to Erwin Bach, whose quiet devotion makes her the anti-Ike of the tale. Oh, and this is the only book I've ever read in which the last page is an organ donor form. Once again, Tina leaves nothing to chance. And speaking of rock stars, we've also got this article. Matthew's Success Hangover. This is published in The Week magazine on the 1st of June, 2018. Dave Matthews sometimes wishes his music wasn't so popular, says David Mertz in New York magazine. I do wonder about the success I've had and whether I deserve it, the 51-year-old singer-songwriter says. The fans of his band's long concert jams are often parodied as drunk white dudes who loudly sing along and dance throughout the performance. We are about a party, Matthews concedes. It's almost like a Jimmy Buffett concert. That dynamic certainly turns a profit. From 2000 to 2010, his band grossed over $529 million, touring North America more than any other artist or group that decade. It's hard to wrap my head around how perversely well-paid I am, he says. His success, in fact, has led to a kind of existential torment. Am I challenging myself? Am I eating my own tail? Am I just feeding off the thing that allowed me to be doing so extraordinarily well? Matthews would like his fans to focus more on his moody songs about the dilemmas of being alive rather than his lighter fare, and to listen more and party less. When I listen to music, I sort of want everyone to be quiet. And in local music news, we have this announcement of an upcoming concert. It's Holiday Cirque Spectacular, and this is Friday, December the 21st at 8 p.m. and Saturday, December the 22nd at 3 p.m. and 8 p.m. My Mandy Concert Hall, Raleigh. Wesley Schultz, the conductor. Stunning aerial feats, mind-boggling contortions, and jaw-dropping juggling acts accompany your favorite festive music. Phone 919-733-2750 or go to ncsymphony.org for more details and ticket information. So how'd you do on today's musical trivia questions? Well, the answer to our first question, it was on this day back in 2014 that Metallica became the first band to perform a concert on all seven of Earth's continents. Which continent was the last one to host the concert? And I gave you the hint that he had already played on Asia, Africa, North America, South America, Europe, and Australia. So which one's missing? Antarctica. Become the first band to perform a concert on all seven. As noted in a December 2013 article in GuinnessWorldRecords.com, the band set the record after they entertained 120 scientists and competition winners in a transparent dome at Carlini Station in Antarctica on Sunday. Metallica actually performed on all seven continents in a single calendar year, 2013. Sunday's hour-long show, appropriately dubbed Frisian Mall, saw the rock band perform 10 tracks, including hits such as 1, Enter Sandman, and Nothing Else Matters. Amplifiers were instead enclosed in isolation cabinets with the sound transmitted to the audience via headphones, similar to silent disco sometimes found at music festivals. And the answer to our second question, what happened on this day back in 1960 when the singer Fabian visited Elvis Presley at Graceland? Was that A, the two got into a fight about the best post-Thanksgiving sandwich? Was it B, Fabian had to lend Elvis his pants because Elvis had ripped his, demonstrating karate? Was it C, they recorded a holiday album together? Or D, Fabian designed what would become Elvis's signature gold lamé jumpsuit? Correct answer, answer B. It was on this day back in 1960 that Fabian visited Elvis Presley and lent him his pants when Elvis ripped his, demonstrated karate. As noted in a 2012 article in Goldmine magazine, Fabian's 1959 movie hit, Hound Dog Man, resembled Elvis's Love Me Tender, released 3 years earlier. Even the photos of each star's wardrobe test are eerily similar. Fabian is forever being criticized as the poor man's Elvis Presley. Fabian remembers the day he met his doppelganger. My road manager told me that Elvis was on the phone and that he wanted to meet me. I asked him why. Fabian said that both of them appeared awkward at first. Elvis was said to be terribly insecure and felt threatened by others who could steal the spotlight. We started laughing and joking around, and Elvis told me he was learning karate. I had four other guys in the room with me. Elvis said, have your four guys surround me. I want to practice my karate. He wanted to do it, and he did it, and he got around them and knocked them all on their ass. He ripped his pants, by the way. I gave him a pair of my pants to wear. That's how I met Elvis Presley. Well, we've run out of time for today's episode of Music Review. And as we leave you, remember these words. Kindness is a language which blind people see and deaf people hear. Be sure to tune in at the same time next week. I'm Randy Thompson, reading for the Triangle Radio Reading Service. Content of this program, intended for people who are blind and print impaired. Music Review, readily available as a podcast after the broadcast in the TRRS website, TriangleReadingService.org. Give me a call if you have a suggestion for music to feature on this program at 919-832-5138. So long, until next time.